Hello! Welcome to the War Pod, the official podcast of the Remote Warfare Program, a London-based research program focusing on remote warfare, the trend where states support local and regional forces in the front lines rather than deploying large numbers of their own troops. The Remote Warfare Program is part of the Oxford Research Group, a peace and security think tank. I'm Megan Costa-Peterson, the Research and Policy Officer.
And I'm Abigail Watson, Research Manager at the Oxford Research Group.
In this episode, we'll be joined by Dan Mahanty and Beatrice Godefroy of Civic to discuss partnered operations and protecting civilians. Enjoy the show.
Following the costly military interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, placing comparable numbers of Western boots on the ground in new conflicts, except in the case of direct threat to state survival, has remained unlikely. Yet while Western governments remain reluctant to deploy their own troops, they continue to be concerned about terrorist activity in the world's ungoverned or weakly governed places. Faced with these competing concerns, the UK and others have supported local and regional forces to do the bulk of frontline fighting against groups like ISIS, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab. There is an assumption that this allows the UK and others to engage abroad while minimising the risk to their own troops, and at the same time, building regional capacity so that foreign states can address these threats more autonomously in the future. However, we have noted how it can have a number of unintended consequences, particularly in three key areas. It can shift the cost of war onto civilians and local partners. It can exacerbate rather than alleviate the drivers of conflict in the places the UK is intervening. And it can potentially undermine democratic controls designed to scrutinise and oversee decisions to use force abroad. These risks have also been a key focus of Dan and Beatrice's work at Civic, so we are very glad to have them with us to discuss all things partnered operations. So first, can I ask you both to introduce yourselves and your work at Civic on this topic?
Yeah, hi, my name is Dan Mahanty. I'm the director of the U.S. program for Center for Civilians in Conflict.
Hi, I'm Beatrice Godefroy. I'm your director for Civic. I'm based out of Geneva, engaging with European stakeholders on this topic, including the French government, the UK government, the Netherlands, as well as the European Union and NATO.
Perfect. And can you perhaps, so Beatrice, could you start off by telling us about a few ways in which states like the UK, France, and other European countries support partners abroad?
So I would say it's, as you know, there is as many ways to address partnered operations as there are countries and organizations in Europe. So it's pretty different depending on the organization and country. Maybe to what I would like to highlight first is the fact that the Europeans are turning and are prioritizing or preferring, let's say, resorting to partnered military operations or security force assistance for the same reasons, I may say, than the US are doing, but also for very specific reasons linked to Europe collective security. It's been 5-6 years since the conflict in Ukraine started, the annexion of Crimea, the mounting tensions between Europe and Russia. So there is a direct threat at the border of Europe that's actually taking a lot of Europe's attention in terms of security and defense. And so faced with this situation, being able to resort to security force assistance activities and to partnered military operations in contexts which may be a priority, but not as much as a priority as the potential great power competition or conflict with other powers like Russia, is a very attractive one. So maybe that's the first point, and that's actually the link between the EU, between France, between the UK, in the way they're actually using security force assistance, in order to release resources and political trends, so to say, to allocate it to other priority areas. Then with regards to the ways these different partners approach partner military operations, let me zoom on France, actually, because they have a very special history and ways to define it, which is pretty different than the one that the US have. First, in terms of definition, they operate a distinction between long-term cooperation and security sector reform, for instance, as well as, regular training centers like the Element Français au Sénégal, for instance, which are somehow part of the history that France has to develop military cooperation with, for instance, African countries. And the other component of security force assistance is encompassed into what they call external operations, OPEX, which include partenariat militaro-opérationnel, so basically military partnerships, and at the operational level, and as well as the conduct of direct military operations. And for instance, the activities that they are doing today in the Sahel are part of the external operations, or OPEX, and they include a combination of both the conduct of the direct military operations and security, military operational partnerships. So I think it's an interesting discussion, and I'm sure Dan is gonna actually explain to us how it works for the US. Then if you look today at what are the two main contexts where France is actually involved in partnered military operations and involved militarily, that's the Middle East and the Sahel. And so interestingly, in the Middle East, where they have the Shamal operations, they are present today in this coalition mostly, I mean, through a number of different components, but a big highlight since the beginning has been the contribution to airstrikes. And then the issues it raises in terms of protection of civilians are obviously very specific, linked to also data and accountability and potential to respond to civilian incidents linked to strikes. While in the Sahel, again, there is this combination of conduct of direct military operations, which are actually counterterrorism operations, and for the first time since long, they're also leading an international coalition, doing a mix of counterterrorism operations and assistance to national and regional forces. So there you have a component that's also including operations on the ground and not only operations from the air, raising other potential risks and challenges in terms of the protection of civilians. And maybe my last comment on France, and we can discuss this a little bit later in the conversation, is that they have a strong approach for their own operations to IHL, to international humanitarian law, its implementation, as well as to develop or to accompany their military presence with civil military actions. They tend to integrate or to reproduce this model in the way they engage and influence their partners. But that model shows a number of gaps in terms of the protection of civilians, because as we know, protection of civilians in military operations is much more than IHL implementation and civil military actions.
Thank you very much. I think that's a really useful overview of a very broad category of engagements. Dan, how do you think that kind of compares to the U.S. experience of support relationships?
Yeah, it's actually always really fascinating and interesting for me to be able to listen to my colleague describe, you know, how the European governments approach this, because the U.S. context is similar in some ways and distinct in others. Let me start by saying first, you know, thanks to Oxford Research Group for having Beatrice and I on, because it's a really great opportunity to talk about some of the ways in which why this is actually important to us and what we're doing about it. You know, the U.S. is kind of a unique case in that, you know, the concept of partnering and supporting and assisting other countries in the security sector goes back, you know, to World War II. It's been around a very long time. And the number of programs and activities and the places in which the U.S. undertakes them has really grown to the point where there's probably a handful of countries where the U.S. doesn't have some kind of partnership or support or assistance activity. And so, you know, the range of activities is as broad as the number of countries in which they take place. But I generally categorize them into a couple of different buckets that might be useful for purposes of this discussion. So the first are ways in which, you know, the U.S. provides some form of support to a country to enable them to be able to conduct security operations on their own, whether that's the provision of intelligence or fuel supplies or other things that kind of, you know, I'd categorize as kind of operational support without, you know, actually becoming involved in hostilities. The second is, you know, the security assistance or the actual support for capacity building or the provision of material, you know, from the United States that enables a country to deal with internal threats or external threats for a variety of different policy purposes. The third are those circumstances in which the U.S. is actually, you know, on the ground or in the air in support of partner forces which I'd probably categorize in that bucket of partnered operations or multinational coalition operations, where there's a much more direct role. Even if the U.S. isn't pulling triggers or actually involved in the fighting, there's a much closer proximity to an actual conflict. And then finally, I include arms sales in the discussion only because the relationship between arms sales and conflict and the ways in which our U.S. arms sales, especially conventional arms sales, involve the U.S. in conflicts around the world has to be considered. Because at the end of the day, not wanting to speak on behalf of Beatrice, but I think, generally speaking, it's okay to acknowledge the fact that civics angle of approach on this is to examine kind of the ways in which the countries in which we work, are able to enhance or not the protection of civilians on the ground in conflict environments. And I think Beatrice shares this opinion, but I defer to her, that in order to have the most comprehensive understanding of what risks are introduced or mitigated by the countries in which we work, namely European countries and the United States, we really have to have a comprehensive accounting of all the different ways that they partake in these activities. And I think very much to your points at the outset of the podcast, what we've seen over the course of years since 9/11 is not only a proliferation of these activities and programs, but a significant deepening, of the levels of involvement, the expansion of budgets, and also just the core belief that these programs and activities are going to yield the kind of outcomes that the U.S. is most interested in. I kind of joke around in saying that the range of security assistance and cooperation activities in the United States have kind of become a Swiss Army knife for policy outcomes. We use it to improve our access. We use it to enhance interoperability with other countries. We use it to enhance their capacity to deal with domestic threats. We use it for sort of the political dividends that come with it in order to strengthen diplomacy and partnerships. And of course, we also look at them as a means of transactional commercial revenue. So there are a lot of reasons and motivations for doing it, a lot of stated benefits, and a lot of risks that we need to pay attention to. So it's a great topic to be discussing today.
I completely agree. And it's always interesting to hear you and Beatrice talk about the Europe and the US respectively, when we hear the exact same concerns and we investigate the exact same concerns in the UK, especially around trying to interrogate whether or not the UK is actually delivering on the claims that it says that partnered operations can bring. I'm interested, from Civic's point of view, what is the work that Civic is doing to try and understand what partnered operations promise and deliver?
Yeah, if it's okay, I'll go ahead and take the lead on that, and then Beatrice, you can answer the first one or the next one first. Let me talk a little bit about what we've done in the U.S. Over the last couple of years, which again, it all starts with this premise that one, or the angle or the lens through which we see this is, risk to civilians, and then two, that we take kind of the broadest possible view of what partnership means. So a lot of the activities and support relationships that we talked about earlier are a part of our work, and we try to understand each of them. So really the first thing we've done is to try to evaluate, given all of that diversity of programs and the ways in which they're applied, what the actual risks are. So we've developed somewhat of a typology, which is based a lot on the work of other great organizations, to include Oxford Research Group, to just best understand when people talk about the risk involved with, support or partnership or cooperation, like what risks exactly are we talking about? What categories do they fall into? How do you, assign certain risks to some programs and not others? So really trying to organize in a kind of more coherent typology what we think the risk factors are that accompany not only acts of partnership, but the risks involved with particular partners. Two, as a derivative of that analysis, what we've tried to do is to best I understand and identify the most appropriate entry points in the players in the large universe of people that are involved with these conversations at the policy level, but also operationally, so we can kind of map out who is it exactly that we should be engaging in a strategy to help refine the approach to these programs in such a way that it delivers better protection outcomes for civilians. And really, that's kind of the last step in this is once we've identified what we think are potentially some helpful recommendations, is to actually start identifying those options on behalf of policymakers and engaging them with them. And what we've ended up with is, I think, is an evolving but already decent menu of options that that includes both recommendations for restraint or kind of risk-based approaches to the provision of assistance or the partner or the partaking in partnerships, but also some affirmative options for the governments. In my case, the U.S. government to take advantage of opportunities to reduce risk. So. We've written a little bit of public research on this in partnership, in my case, with the Center for Strategic International Studies and Interaction. We've engaged with the Pentagon on the development of their new policy on civilian casualties. We've been engaging with other parts of the government. And I can elaborate more on some of the specifics, but that just gives you a general overview of the way we've tackled this.
Beatrice, did you want to add anything else?
Yeah, just a couple of points. It's so interesting to compare or to be able to discuss together Europe and the US. Thank you very much for the opportunity. One thing is when you speak about, when you think about the type of work that you need to do if you want to engage European stakeholders on this question, it's because it's Europe, it's necessarily an addition of different governments and addition plus the EU plus other potential organizations. And so the objective of an organization like CIVIC is going to, of course, we're going to want to have an impact on the policies and practices which lead to better global standards, including in, having POC better integrated in security force assistance. But at the end of the day, we're also doing this because we aim to create a positive impact for the populations on the ground, and especially those which are affected by conflicts today. And so so if we want to have this impact, take a context like the Sahel or like Middle East, for instance, you need to actually play and work and engage with different countries, with the European Union, of course, with other international stakeholders and regional stakeholders. There are many more actually than Europeans and Americans involved in security force assistance in most of the very sensitive areas in the world, from the Horn of Africa to Middle East to Sahel. And having this possibility to actually engage and influence the interlocutors that can make a difference on the ground. And if you take Europe, since they, European governments and the EU on critical contexts tend to try and work hand in hand together on these topics, there's going to be a fraction of the response or the leverage that's going to be with one, another fraction that's going to be with the other. So it's a fragmented work. But so as an example of the type of work that we've been developing, it's been as much as engaging with the European Union on the Sahel strategy, on the risk management framework to CSDP mission, which are basically missions and operations related to security and assistance. But it's been also engaging with France, the Coalition for the Sahel, as well as other European governments who are members to the coalition to develop this approach. And then maybe my last point is the approach is fragmented necessarily. Hopefully it's we help and create complementarity or consistency between the different blocks or bits and pieces, I was going to say. But the difficulty is also that you start with interlocutors who actually have different understandings, awareness, comprehension of what we mean by protection of civilians in military operations. So themselves, for instance, France or the UK, we have a different tradition, a different understanding of what POC means in military operations. And the way they're going to engage with their partners is going to be affected by their own tradition and their own history. So So that's a little bit this level of complexity that we need to integrate.
And you've gone through the work that you've been doing to try and track some of the potential risks. And just to say that all the work that you've you've mentioned while you've been talking has been really influential in our own work, and we'll also include it in the show notes for anyone that hasn't read it. But it would be great if you could outline some of the risks that you've noted when doing this work into partnered operations, and specifically what are the risks to civilians in these areas where these operations are being undertaken?
Yeah, I can start with that one, if that's okay, and then maybe we can get into some of the specifics. If I start with generalities here, let me start a little bit about the categories I mentioned earlier, because I do think that's helpful to kind of, you know, sorting out and making sure that we cover all of the risks in the work which we do, which I think is important, because there isn't, as you all know, an abundant literature on this. But I think what tends to happen when we talk about these activities and quote risk, people tend to mentally conjure something in their own minds about what they think that means. And I think a lot of times in my own discussions here in the U.S., people tend to think of it as, you know, kind of what I'd put in the first category, which is that, you know, through its support activities or programs, the U.S. is directly or could directly contribute to, you know, a specific kind of undesired consequence when it comes to risks for civilians, namely, you know, actual misconduct on the part of security forces, human rights abuses, et cetera, exacerbating, you know, corruption by providing material support to a country where this security sector, you know, is misgoverned or is subject to, you know, forms of corruption. Or in our case, we tend to look a lot at, you know, civilian casualties. So the risk that by providing certain forms of material assistance or support, you know, we might be directly contributing to an onward or an ongoing, I should say, trend of civilian casualties. But there are other risks that we've encountered that might not be quite as, you know, direct in their relationship to civilian harm, but you still have to consider when you think about civilian harm. Namely, that acts of partnership can create gaps in the oversight and accountability and the delivery of services from security force actors on behalf of civilians. And that can be, you know, both as a function of intentional and unintentional, you know, forms of partnership. I don't think in most cases the U.S. military wants to contribute to a gap in accountability, or, you know, is willing to say that there is a, you know, that the difference in levels of transparency is anything more than just kind of different sovereign states dealing with their publics in different ways. But nonetheless, you know, you can actually create, I think, significant issues for civilians who are seeking greater accountability or redress for harm that they suffered. And if it's made more difficult because of an active partnership, you know, that's something we have to take into account. You know, another great example of that is in multinational coalition operations where, you know, states, you know, believe that collective action is the most cost efficient or effective, the most, you know, the best way to distribute risk, and frankly, the best way to combine forces against, you know, challenging adversaries. But what can happen is, you know, when you know, a coalition isn't a, you know, something that enjoys like legal character. It is a group of states that are fighting together. And so if there's civilian harm that results from a coalition operation, there may not be one particular state to point to, you know, in terms of, or to call in terms of getting redress for civilian harm. So those kinds of risks are also things that we need to consider in addition to kind of the more direct, you know, directly proximate kinds of risk relationships that people tend to think of. I also think at Civic, you know, we're willing to acknowledge the fact that part of the risks involved here are those of missed opportunities. The fact that the countries that Beatrice and I both work in do have strong relationships and do wield some influence in the places where they're undertaking these operations. And really, because of that, have an opportunity to do something to help enhance protection outcomes for civilians, you know, in partnership with other countries, and also to learn from their partners the best ways to go about doing that. So even as we're looking at risk mitigation in terms of, you know, doing less of one bad thing or moderating an activity or enhancing oversight and accountability, there are these other, you know, opportunities that if missed, I think just creates the risk that we're not, you know, looking, you know, deeply enough for some great opportunities to have a positive influence. You know, for their part, in my engagement with the U.S. military, I think they also need to think about two other categories of risk that, you know, we're willing to sensitize them to, but really are on them to take, you know, full consideration of, you know, one, of course, is whether or not, you know, inadequate attention to the risk of civilian harm or civilian harm actually occurring can really be detrimental to their operational and strategic, and quite frankly, their policy, desired policy outcomes. And we've, in the United States, learned this, you know, in our history as a country for decades, that these are not tactical or operational issues that are, you know, easy or should be easy to ignore. They are things that can very much affect the way that the United States is perceived, its political objectives, and kind of even its the security outcomes that it's aiming to achieve. So I think that and the reputational risk that it risks, you know, when it doesn't give adequate attention to these things, is something that U.S. policymakers really need to take into account, in addition to the way that CIVIC really focuses on the risk to civilians themselves.
And Beatrice, is there anything that you wanted to add to that from your perspective?
Well, I agree with everything that Dan has been saying. Actually, it's super comprehensive. Just a couple of points to add to one of the last points that he said. From the few risk matrices or documents I've seen from, you know, EU or different governments, there is indeed sometimes a mix between the risk to civilians and the risk to the organization or government in question. And so the reflection on what we mean or what is meant by civilian risks and the different categories, the different implications, the different things that you need to take into consideration is most of the time very insufficient to be able to cover the area of risk, but also to then take the appropriate, the adequate, policy decisions that follow. So very often I've seen a mix of, for instance, things on gender, and then a little bit on fight against impunity, and then a little bit of perception and image risk for the security forces. So there is a lot of different elements, and nothing that looks like a systematic approach and understanding of what are the threats and risks to civilian populations. And then maybe the second point I wanted to make is there's also again, because of history and different traditions and culture, for some of the European governments, the idea that if there is something that is being done in terms of training, for instance, international humanitarian law training, as well as other activities such as civil military actions or funding of humanitarian assistance or similar type of things, that they get it covered. So basically that... Since the analysis and the understanding of the risk is relatively limited or insufficient, likewise the understanding and the mapping of the actions that need to be taken is insufficient as well. And so there is there can be in some situation a sense that basically the risks have been well identified and they are well covered because we are doing training in IHR implementation, for instance, which again is a very good thing to do, but not a sufficient one.
I think maybe Beatrice will just pick up on your points a bit more, because I think it's really interesting what you're saying about how many different nations have all these different systems, and there's very rarely any kind of real coordination between the different systems. So it'd be good to hear from both of you how states are trying to mitigate against these risks of harm to civilians.
That's a tricky one.
It's a big question, sorry.
Yeah. Question is actually that's a question on which we need at least for I'm speaking a lot about the Sahel, but it is the big context where the EU, European governments, France, UK are all involved today and ramping up their collaboration towards security and counterterrorism objectives. And so we would need more research actually on that. My initial instinct or perspective is that again there is a common background, a common culture, a common tradition of course, we have here governments who want to uphold humanitarian principles, the implementation of international humanitarian law, who for some of them have produced, like is the case for France and Germany last year, the call for action on the protection of civilians and humanitarian assistance at the UN Security Council. So we have, countries, governments, the EU, who have a strong history and tradition to care and support civilians in conflicts. However, I'm not sure, again, how far or let's say how systematic the integration of POC is at all levels of the coalition that is being built, and beyond the coalition of the security infrastructure or setup that is actually operative today in the Sahel. Again, there is some part of support that's expected from MINUSMA. There is the new mandate and the reinforced actually expectations vis-à-vis EUTM, the EU training missions, in terms of their role in training and now a little bit more of mentoring. There is the Coalition for the Sahel, there is Barkhane, there's also I understand that it's not a joint état-major, but it's a coordination in terms of the planning military operations for the joint Fort Jifar Sahel and Barkhane operations. So there's really a very fragmented and complex security architecture, so complexity in the military partnership itself. And in this circumstance, I'm not sure there's been a full mapping, understanding, and systematic analysis and then systematic integration of POC at all of the different political, strategic, operational, and tactical level, and that would be very much needed, as we see from the rise in violations and exactions coming from the different security forces in the regions today.
Yeah, I think broadly speaking, I really agree strongly with Beatrice's points. The U.S. it's interesting. It's a little bit like that saying, they want to have their cake and eat it too. I think in part. It's very difficult to establish, more consistency, and more evenness when it comes to really tackling the risks that are involved with the range of these activities, because it really isn't the primary political objective in a number of places to do so. And I think there's the belief that you can do, just enough risk mitigation at the same time as you're achieving other objectives, even if you're achieving them or pursuing them in ways that could be, detrimental to civilians on the ground. And so I think a couple of things would probably be worth advising. One, I think in cases where either by virtue of the level of support or because of the degree of risk involved, civilian harm or, whether you're defining that as unintentional civilian casualties or human rights abuses or wide-scale, ineffectiveness of the security forces, the government, the U.S. government really needs to elevate as a policy matter its attention to minimizing the risk of its own interventions. In other places, it's really not quite that simple, and it's a much more mixed bag of risks, and it's not quite as, it may not come across as disruptive or as, potentially even fatal to the success of the overall experiment. And so I think in those cases, the U.S. just like Beatrice mentioned, just needs to come up with, I think, a more systematic approach to the way it's both assessing risk and then being very honest in the way it assesses its capacity to do something about it. There was a great article this morning by your former colleague, Emily Knowles, on whether or not the inability to measure human rights training is necessarily a bad thing, because I think one of the major points we want to reinforce here is that we don't want people overstating the benefits of certain tactical interventions for risk mitigation if, in fact, they're not having the desired outcome, where a political level approach, a strategy that's kind of nested into the policy on risk mitigation is really what's needed. So I think those two things would be potentially advisable in the way that the U.S. approaches this. But I do think when we go back and look at those buckets of activities, there are ways that you can attend to each a certain number of things that can be done within the U.S. government to manage risk, if not to mitigate it outright. And happy to talk about some of those things.
Thank you both. Again, it really resonates with what we found on the UK front as well, especially this idea that you both spoke to, that when these operations are not given the strategic importance that they need, they end up just becoming a risk-free thing to do something which is probably unrelated to the activity that they are doing. So you have soldiers building capacity of partners to build influence with France, but then what does that mean for the actual effect on the ground, and how much that then improves or hinders the eventual prospects for peace and stability in the places that the UK is intervening. And I think it comes to some of the recommendations that we've laid out as well, this idea that if you are just going in to build influence, or you're just going in to stake the UK claim or build on the UK's objectives, it's going to be completely ineffective unless it's built into an international effort which looks at the actual need in a country and tries to address it.
I just to have conversation with that point in it for a moment. I think that's so true, and that's why I think this research and the work that you guys are doing is so critical as we start to see this, the introduction more and more often of this whole notion of like countering other great powers. And Beatrice mentioned this earlier, in these so-called, hybrid environments, as though these places are not independently important on their own right, and as if the people in those countries, don't have a stake to, a claim to their own futures. So I really think that even as we kind of come out of the so-called era of counterterrorism, it's almost as though we're entering a new era where some of these questions are going to be as or more important. So really great point.
And then just looking forward around how we address this, just thinking about some of the work that we've been doing and also that you've been doing, Dan, thinking about working with the local level to ask what the true needs are. When we go in going forward in understanding partnered operations and how we mitigate against some of these risks, is the local element going to be an essential part of making sure that we don't make matters worse?
I think so. And, I'll speak briefly here because I think Beatrice probably has some, something to say about this as well. I think that question was directed to me, so you can edit out this editorial later. But I do think there is. But, what's interesting is, this idea of interacting with or engaging civilians or civil society or the public is something that one does have some established record and practice when it comes to some kinds of activities, interventions. And it is something that has gained, I think, traction in the way people are talking about, a successful strategy or approach more generally. Where I think we could all stand to benefit would be to tease out some of the specifics. At what stage in the planning, design, implementation, evaluation, even funding of programs, activities, should we be thinking about, or should the U.S. government be thinking about the way it's interacting with local publics? What are the risks involved to local publics, to include civil society in seeking their perspectives? How and where does the burden fall between the U.S. government and its partners when it comes to undertaking those interactions? What are some of the other unintended consequences that we want to avoid in terms of, allowing certain organizations or individuals to set the agenda? And in other words, to make sure that we're, commending an inclusive approach that's going to benefit not just some, but everybody. So there's a lot of work and research to be done in this area that I think is really rich and important. I'll just do a little bit of a self plug. We're we're in the middle of an intense research project right now, looking at some of at least the preliminary aspects of this question, with hopes that we can even do more research down the road. Starting with some of those kind of tactical questions. How do you integrate, consultation and engagement with civilians, with civil society, as a country that is undertaking a form of intervention in a third country? There's a ton of great literature out there on general principles of practice, but very little when it comes to security assistance and cooperation that we think is really worth exploring. So I'll turn over to Beatrice to see what thoughts she has.
Thanks, Dan. And I'm sorry, I'm going to pedal back a little bit just to the previous question before speaking to your point on civil society. Just wanted to mention also in terms of the risks and the mitigation measure and the adaptations that Europeans and European governments and the EU are doing. There's been, in the context of the Sahel, they have been pushed in an area, or let's say, they have entered certain areas which they were not used to enter before. And the nature of the type of security force assistance activity that they do is fairly different and going into a much more robust approach than what they used to do in the past. For instance, the EU has been with EU training missions doing training since a long time. This includes training on international humanitarian law, but of course many more modules of training today. And we've seen this again with the new mandate. They are looking at how they can be more efficient to support the overall military response and an international strategy. And for that, they are entering into areas such as mentoring. So I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that, as you know, European governments and the EU are entering into this new approach, which are going to be very challenging for their forces themselves, going to be very challenging in terms of reputation, but also potentially beyond that. There's going to be even more elements to think in terms of the protection of civilians. And maybe a last point on the Sahel. I'm speaking too much of this context, I know, but it's so interesting. There is definitely, in terms of the a risk, which for civilian population comes from exactions or violations or incidents from security forces, for national security forces or regional security forces. But obviously, this takes place in an environment where jihadism, criminality, intercommunal violences, and many more areas are also very important threats to civilians. And so I just wanted to acknowledge the challenge and the risks to civilians. On the one hand, there is a risk that is linked to the modality from international communities and different stakeholders working in a coalition mode or working in with a combination basically of partnered military operations. But at the same time, this comes in response to a very challenging environment for which I think there's been no, you know, magic recipe that has been learned from Afghanistan or Iraq. We know what doesn't work, and we know definitely that not responding and addressing and preventing civilian incidents is definitely creating a risk to fuel radicalization, but we don't know actually what works. So there is this balance and this dilemma that Europeans are facing and other international actors and national actors are facing today in the Sahel, to try and find how they can act differently, including in the way they interact with one another, to address their security objectives. And then in terms of the civil society engagement, this is an extremely important question. And I think the work that Dan is doing is going to be extremely informative, not only from the US perspective, but also from the perspective of European governments, including on two areas which I've seen repeatedly as gaps on the side of my interlocutors. One, civil-military coordination needs to be reinforced, prioritized, acknowledged as a critical element to not only articulate military humanitarian assistance with military operations, but also as a way to engage a dialogue between NGOs and civil societies and the military. And these functions very often face a lot of challenges, to say the least. So they need to be acknowledged. But civil-military coordination is not sufficient. There should be more areas or more ways for civil society and the military in a given context, at the very local level, at the national level, to engage and to create a dialogue and initiatives that go in this direction, including some of the initiatives that Civic is doing, but also other organizations to, again, create ways for civil-military direct engagement should definitely be welcomed. And most of the time, there is sort of a blind spot on this question, which triggers which creates potentially negative effects in terms of tensions between civilians and militaries on the ground.
This is an incredibly interesting discussion, and I wish we had many more hours to go on. We are going to have to start rounding up soon, though. But maybe just to say that we very much agree with your focus on the Sahel and how it is a very good case study of how POC, like Dan was saying before, it's not just about humanitarianism, it's not just about ethics. It has real political consequences, it has real strategic consequences. And so having a strong approach to this is really very important, especially in remote warfare as well. And we actually, our colleague Liam Walpole did another podcast last month with two experts from the Danish Institute for International Studies on this as well. So we'll link to that in the program notes. And with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to start rounding up.
So thank you both, and thank you to all our listeners for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did. For those who want to read more in depth about the topics we covered, we've put links to any research or publications that we have mentioned in the episode notes. If you want to stay up to date with remote warfare and the Oxford Research Group's work, please subscribe to our newsletter by clicking on the button at the top of the page. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handles are at orginfo and at remote_warfare, and you can also donate on our page. You can listen to all previous episodes of our podcast free of charge by following the link at the top of the page. We look forward to joining you again soon. Bye.